Hi, this is Dark Journalist. Today we have a special exclusive interview with Dr. Joseph Farrell on his new book, Hidden Finance, Rogue Networks, and Secret Sorcery, The Fascist International, 9/11, and Penetrated Operations. The book is a long-awaited investigation into the deep state political and black budget forces that benefited from the attacks on September 11th. Now, Dr. Farrell's deep research reveals disturbing facts concerning a fascist international syndicate and covert forces that played a major role in the most defining event of our time. Is it an accident that we find ourselves in a surveillance state with armed drones in our skies? Militarization of police departments across America? And a secretive, all-powerful national security state that's growing rapidly? Prepare for some eye-opening revelations. Here we go. Dr. Joseph Farrell, 9/11 and the Fascist International Trap.
Whatever they're covering up with 9/11, it's the presence of this third level and the fact that the operation that they had planned so carefully was penetrated, and in the process, they panicked for a period of time. To my mind, Daniel, this is the third layer. You've got a fascist element, call it Mr. Global, like Catherine Austin Fitz calls it. Whatever this entity is, I think that's the entity at that deepest third level behind 9/11.
You know, deep events have been embedded in the very fabric of American society since the JFK assassination over 50 years ago. From Watergate, Iran-Contra, the October surprise, to the creation of the WTO, there's been a steady effort by covert groups inside and outside of government to consolidate and centralize power to dominate the lives of the public. 9/11 and the subsequent authoritarian policies developed in its wake have threatened the very notion of a free and open society. But who organized it? One thing is for certain. The official story has been discredited by multiple sources. So let's go talk to Dr. Joseph Farrell.
Dark Journalist will go there. The deepest issues, the hardest stories, the biggest secrets. The truth is never easy. With top guests, like former Assistant Housing Secretary Catherine Austin Fitz.
Catherine, who is really behind this media censorship?
Internet feeds go through satellites. Who controls the satellites? It's the Pentagon.
Legendary investigator Graham Hancock.
Graham, this cataclysm must have destroyed an advanced culture in our ancient past.
It truly was an extinction-level event. It was accompanied by massive animal extinctions. It was accompanied by huge and unexplained sea level rises, and then a sudden plunge of global temperatures.
Best-selling author Jim Mars.
Jim, don't these elite corporate owners need us around to buy their GMO food? Why would they want to depopulate?
Because they are eugenicists and they believe that they need to purify the human race. And if that sounds like the Nazis, that's exactly what it is.
Coast to Coast AM investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe.
Linda, how are we going to scale that wall of UFO secrecy?
Humans themselves are bypassing, are beginning to dismiss all of the policies of denial and lie.
Dark journalists will go there. Visit darkjournalist.com and subscribe now for a special spring discount available for just $39 for one full year. You'll not only receive access to the complete audio archives to stream or download at your convenience, you'll also get exclusive subscriber-only content and Dark Journalist event discounts. Sign up for our free newsletter to stay updated on the latest shows. Dark Journalist, let's get the real story in 2016.
You know, we need dark journalists, so just keep doing what you're doing.
Well, everyone, I think I told you that May was going to be loaded with revelations, and today will be one of the biggest. If you've ever wondered about the events of 9/11 and the authoritarian policies developed since, then this special series of episodes will give us all a lot to think about. So make sure you're signed up for the Dark Journalist newsletter so you can get these important episodes when they come out. And I can see that the rest of May and June have some real breakthrough episodes happening, so make sure you're on board. Joseph, it's great to have you back on the show. The book is intriguing from beginning to end, And I highly recommend it. I think it's one of your best books.
Thanks for having me back.
And we're going to dive in deep into the implications of it all. But first, I wanted to ask you, since I know that the event had a huge impact on you, where you were when you first got the news and what you were doing. And when did you first realize that the event was not exactly what it seemed to be?
Well, yeah, I came home from the casino. I was the ranking graveyard shift floor manager. And I got off my shift early that morning. I came home. I went to bed. I had a friend staying with me at the time. And just as I was going to bed, he was coming out of the guest room and getting up. And I said goodnight and went to bed. And the next thing I hear, as I'm kind of dozing off, you know, to sleep, I hear, oh, my God, you know, coming from the living room. And this didn't stop, you know. So finally, I got back up, put on my bathrobe, came out and said, what's going on? And he just gestured like that. And he said, look. And, you know, there on the television was the North Tower burning. And as we were watching that, the South Tower was struck. And instantly, I thought, oh, no. You know, one plane hitting a building is coincidence. Two is an attack.
Yeah.
And so I stayed up and watched as the morning proceeded. And then we had the Pentagon and we had the fires in the old executive office building right next to the White House there in D.C. And as I'm watching, and as the talking heads are beginning to put out the theory that, oh, you know, there's some danger that the towers might collapse because of the fires. And at that point, I thought, no, that's a meme that they're starting to drive. And that means if they're starting to plant that meme, then this is an inside job. And then the peculiar behavior of President Bush, you know, he gave that press conference at the elementary school, says he's going to be flying back to Washington. And then the next thing we know, he's turning up at Barksdale in Louisiana. He gave that talk and no mention of terrorism, which had been up to that point being driven and driven and driven. I thought, gee, that's peculiar, Barksdale. And then he goes on to Offutt. And I thought, whoa, there's something else going on here. Besides, you know, those are the command headquarters and backup command headquarters for the nuclear arsenal. And I thought, whoa, this is far beyond terrorism. There's something else going on. And then the towers came down. And I remember, Daniel, watching that happen. And I thought, oh, my God, that is not standard controlled demolitions. That is not the result of a fire. That is some very sophisticated, it looked to me like, just like Judy Wood, it looked to me like it was an exotic energy technology.
Right.
I wasn't even thinking at that time in terms of standard controlled demolitions or mini nukes or nanothermite or any of the stuff that came out later. I was thinking, yeah, this thing is being peeled like a banana, and it's falling apart as it's being peeled. I thought, no, there's a problem here. There's a third level. And the reason I thought that was, number one, we had the terrorist narrative. Even that morning we were hearing about Osama bin Laden.
Mm-hmm.
Then Bush's strange flights. I thought immediately, this is a penetrated operation. We've definitely got clear evidence of planning from within the American military and intelligence community, but the towers coming down was overkill for even level two to inject power into the Middle East. All that would have been necessary is to hit the Twin Towers, not bring them down, and bring them down in the way that they were brought down.
Right.
So immediately on 9/11 itself, I was thinking in terms, this is a three level operation with the deepest level penetrating the other two. And I haven't changed my thinking since.
Yes. And this is probably a really good time to spell out those three different levels and what they represent. So can you do that for us now?
The three levels, in my opinion, the first level is the patsies, the hijackers, the official narrative, and nothing more. The second level is the level of planning and coordination that would have and could have only come from within the American military intelligence complex. You have all of those concurrent drills that are mirroring exact aspects of the actual level one operation. So that's the second level.
Okay.
The third level is a level which is aware of the other two and which turns the entire operation against level two.
Huh.
All right. So in other words, it's coming from somewhere else. And I think that on 9/11, the presence of that third level was made known to level two. And that's why you see some of the panic that you see happening. Very carefully disguised panic, but panic nonetheless.
Right. And certainly in your research, you've identified this post-war Nazi fascist international group and followed them through all of their different activities, from South American drug running to development of the EU and the infiltration of Wall Street and the CIA. So you've got this major basis of research. Is it safe to assume then that this third level operation on 9/11 is this other group?
Yeah, I think it's a global fascist Nazi network.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not, by that, I don't necessarily mean for people to think in terms of Germans. You know, I think it's a truly international network with an American component, obviously. But I do think that this was involved because there are, I deliberately began the book by putting out the first Whopper doozy in chapter one. You know what I'm referring to.
Mm-hmm.
And then followed it up later in another chapter with another Whopper doozy, indicating that there are Nazi connections to all of this. Let's begin with the Saudis. We're going through this debate right now. We've seen the stories about this 28-page document that is classified that was given to the 9/11 Commission. And the Bush administration clamped down the seal on this. And most people speculate that this document reveals the very heavy Saudi role in 9/11. And to my mind, there's no doubt that the Saudis are involved at level two.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And the important thing that people have to get a handle on here is that Senator Graham, Senator Bob Graham, retired senator from Florida, and Senator Richard Shelby, the minority senator from Alabama, have both come out and said that they want this to be declassified. And Shelby said, I think it was Shelby, it may have been Graham, but one of them said that this classified document reveals the role of foreign governments in 9/11. In other words, they used the plural.
Right.
And in the context, obviously, the Saudis are one of the governments that they're implicating. But the fact that they use the plural means there's other entities involved. And this is the key point here. The question then becomes, which is that entity? Who is that entity? I think the Israelis are deeply involved at level two. And the reason why, and I'm belaboring level two because you can't understand level three without level two. If you look at all of the intelligence agencies in the world that are warning the United States that something's going to happen, look who you have. You've got Egypt, Jordan, Israel, Russia, France, Germany, the Philippines even. So you've got this whole, and Canada, you've got this whole list of countries that are warning the United States something is going to happen. Why is that significant? It's significant because if each of them has fingers in part of the pie, that means that what's carrying out level three is a global network unconnected to any of the individual countries warning us.
Uh-huh.
And I hope that makes sense because it's crucial to understand from this point out what's going on. Tony Blair at that time came out and gave a statement, as I mentioned in the book, where he pointed out that Al-Qaeda is tied to, in his words, quote, a global network, unquote. And he never specifies what that global network is. But he is pointing out that there's a third player on the scenes, And that's crucial.
So let's get into the first major revelation here that comes early in the book. And it's about the main hijacker, Mohammed Atta.
Okay, this is the first whopper doozy. I put this in the first chapter just to shock people into realizing that they are dealing with a third level. Atta was recruited in Cairo. He ends up in Hamburg, Germany, where he stays for a few years in the home of a German couple in Hamburg. And then from Hamburg, he and some of the other hijackers eventually make their way to that flight school in Venice, Florida, that's being run by a Dutchman by the name of Rudy Deckers. When he's in Florida, Atta has friends that are very peculiar for a Muslim fundamentalist to have. Number one, he's going around to all of these titty bars and getting drunk and having drug parties. You know, this is not the behavior you would think of for a pious Muslim.
Right.
And the friends that he has in Florida are almost exclusively Swiss German or Dutch. And he's seen with these people all the time and having meetings with them. So dig a little deeper, and this is what the research of Douglas Hopsicker found. He found that Atta had been sponsored to Germany by a German couple whose names are never mentioned anywhere in the 9/11 literature, who recruited him when he was in Cairo. They brought him to Germany and hooked him up with the Karl Duisberg Gesellschaft, which sponsored him as a, quote, scholar. And when you dig into the Karl Duisberg Gazelle, when I saw that, the needle went immediately into the red suspicion zone.
Okay? Yeah, I can imagine.
I know the name Karl Duisberg and what he is, you know.
Right.
And the fact that this fact is squatting in the middle of the whole 9/11 research community, and none of them, with the exception of one individual, none of them know the significance.
That's so interesting.
Karl Duisberg was the chairman of the German chemicals firm Bayer during World War I and shortly after. And therefore, he is one of the founding members of IG Farben.
That's amazing.
So in other words, you've got an IG Farben society, essentially, that's sponsoring Mohammed Atta to come to Germany. And then he ends up in the United States at this flight school being run by Dutch and being visited constantly by Germans, some of whom are supplying him money.
That's unreal.
Now, as if that's not enough, one of Otto's associates is a fellow by the name of Peter Boringer from Switzerland, who, when you read this guy, I mean, this guy is a racist, anti-Semite, you name it. And this guy is either... There's no two ways about this. This guy's either a radical Muslim or a Nazi or both.
Okay, so he's a real winner here.
That's the only way to color this. And, you know, I put it out there in the first chapter just to kind of wake people up. I'm not saying this proves that Level 3 is a fascist international, but it is an odd thing because the Karl Duisberg Society, in its turn, is being sponsored by people like the Rockefellers, by Henry Kissinger, James Baker III. There's a Bush connection for you.
Whoa, you know? That's a major one, too.
You know, and in addition to that, it's got some sort of semi-official tie to the German government.
What does the society do exactly?
The society supposedly is to help young people from less developed countries, you know, the whole globalist nine yards, all right?
Oh, I got it. All right.
And the fact for me that it's the Karl Duisberg Gesellschaft is significant for another reason, because it's established in 1949,
uh-huh,
which takes me back to the whole wartime Hotel Maison Rouge meeting that Bormann had, where he basically tells the German industrialists, okay, you're going to open up a bunch of front companies, and societies and foundations would be one aspect of that. and we're going to funnel Nazi Party money to you, and you're going to have Nazi liaison officers, and we're going to use this to build Germany and Europe back up after the war.
And again, this is Martin Bormann, who was Hitler's right-hand man and essentially the leader of the post-war Nazi power group that you're talking about. So what is the essence and significance of this 1949 meeting? What does it have to do with the society?
So in other words, the timing of the founding of the Karl Duisberg Society is, to me, highly suspect. So you've got all of these coincidences working now with Mohammed Atta. He's got this very odd connection to a society with its own very odd connection to IG Farben,
Wow. Well, what's amazing about that, and what I think shows that they were trying to hide his connections early on, was a strange report that there was a recording floating around out there that he had met with Czech intelligence previous to 9/11.
Right.
And later on, of course, the story got pulled, but they had pushed it pretty hard there early on. And I always wondered, what would he be doing meeting with Czech intelligence?
Exactly.
Well, he spent a lot of time in Germany.
And there's some researchers that come right out and say, Hofsecker among them, that the key to 9/11 lies in Germany. Now, that's a disturbing statement in itself, you know.
Well, in light of your research.
In the light of my research, it's very disturbing, I got to tell you, I shared that bit of information about Atta before the book was done with a person that's very well known to you and me both.
Right.
And she said, oh, my God.
Yeah.
Her initial reaction. She says, oh, my God, that's huge. And no one gets this. And
really a breakthrough.
So, yeah, I'm not basing the case on that fact alone. Huh. But there's another fact that, to my mind, almost cinches the fact that whatever they're covering up with 9/11, it's the presence of this third level and the fact that the operation that they had planned so carefully was penetrated, and in the process, they panicked for a period of time. You know, Dick Cheney disappeared for months after 9/11, and when asked what he was doing, well, he's doing security work. Well, I suspect that what Cheney was doing was cleaning out the national security structure and recalibrating code names and shutting down all the access points that they suspected may have been accessed on 9/11 by Level 3. But anyway, there's another connection, and it goes back to the Saudis and the Bin Laden group. Mm-hmm. And this connection to me was when I found it, Daniel, you know, Atta was the clue that there was more there. And I really had to dig to find this, and I did. The Bin Laden Group in Saudi Arabia, as everybody knows, is a huge multi-billion-dollar construction firm, and they have their fingers into just about every little pie that you can think of, satellites, telephone communications, you know, you name it, they're into it. Their banker, up until 1996, I believe, was a fellow in Switzerland by the name of François Genoux, okay? A Swiss-French guy. François Genoux, when you dig into him, was quite literally the banker for the Nazi International. Why? Because he was the financial executor of the estate of Joseph Goebbels.
Oh. So he's deep in there.
Yeah, he's just right in there. He was the financial backer or financial agent for Hitler's personal estate. He was running all of the Nazi bank accounts after the war in Switzerland. He was a personal friend to the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, al-Husseini, who, of course, raised all those Muslim SS divisions for Hitler during the war. He was his banker. He was the banker for the Malmo Sweden group of Nazis. He was the financier for the terrorist congress in Barcelona, Spain in the 1970s that included such luminaries as Yasser Arafat, SS Lieutenant Colonel Otto Skorzeny. So, you know, this guy was, no doubt about it, a Nazi banker. And guess what? He's the banker for the Bin Ladens.
Oh.
He's the guy that hooked the Bin Ladens up with, guess who? Our good friends at Deutsche Bank.
Okay. Oh, it's a real mover and a shaker.
So, you know, for me, this sort of closes the circle.
Yeah.
What they don't want for anyone to find out with the Saudi connection is the Nazi connection, and that's the deeper level. Because you cannot finance international terrorism without a global intelligence network and without a global financial network. And at the same time, you cannot penetrate American operations unless you've got a presence in their security apparatus in addition to all of this, which we know that they did since the end of World War II. So in other words, to me, I think what 9/11 was in a certain sense, and I suggested this, I hinted at this in the third way when I said that the war on terrorism may be a war, a camouflaged war that's against something entirely different.
Right.
And I think that something is this international global fascist mafia, whatever you want to call it, that is really behind everything. I think 9/11, therefore, was the divorce. When the towers came down, the divorce papers were served.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a mad scramble ever since because nobody knows who the real enemy is. I mean, Islam cannot do anything on its own without importing it from the West. Nazis, on the other hand, are perfectly capable of pulling something like this off without any regard to human life and using Islam as the pawns on the chessboard to do it. So to my mind, Daniel, this is the third layer. You've got a fascist element, call it Mr. Global, like Catherine Austin Fitz calls it. You know, whatever this entity is, I think that's the entity at that deepest third level behind 9/11. And they serve the divorce papers to level two and level one all at once.
Extraordinary. And we could say that the original marriage took place at the end of World War II and included the creation of the Bilderberg Group and the S&C Wall Street players,
right,
which inaugurated all of these deep connections, including intelligence agencies.
Right, yeah. The marriage takes place when Alan Dulles is put in contact with SS General Karl Wolf in 1944. Guess who puts them into contact with each other?
Who is it?
François Genoux.
Oh, there he is again. He's a real major player.
He's the little financial spider with his fingers in all these pies, and he's the one introducing General Wolf to Alan Dulles. And then, of course, Reinhard Gehlen follows up. They make that deal, you know, well, we'll keep all of this Nazi intelligence network in place because we need it to fight the communists, you know. Well, talk about a stupid deal. I mean, you're going to trust Nazis?
Yeah, great plan. And this is amazing because the guy's work spans from the 40s and the war years to the 90s.
All the way up to the 90s.
So yep. 50 years mm-hmm. of secretive financial influence right at the heart
right.
of these hidden geopolitics.
Right. And let's not forget, he's from Switzerland. All right. And there's that other guy, Peter Boehringer, that had this close relationship with Mohammed Atta, and he's from Switzerland, espousing ideas that can only be called Nazi.
Right, exactly.
There's no two ways about it. So yeah, I think the circle closes rather dramatically.
Well, we're really seeing the outlines now much more clearly of these connections. And there's a couple of directions we could go into here, but I want to look at Osama bin Laden for a moment.
Sure.
And then we can backtrack into his family.
Uh-huh.
Now, bin Laden could be looked at as an unusually good intelligence asset.
Yes.
He certainly was deeply involved with the Mujahideen fighting in Afghanistan against our enemies, the Soviets, and he was presumably on our side at the time.
Right, exactly. That's how he got his start, the CIA sponsorship.
Yes. Yeah. So he has that relationship, and they work closely with him. But you point out some very interesting reports in the book about him being at an American hospital only a few weeks before 9/11.
Yeah, and this was the French learned that he had been at an American hospital in Dubai, met with a CIA case officer, and French radio ran this whole report, and it was immediately denounced by the United States. And the French, again, you know, went like that and reran the report and some additional research concluding that he was there meeting with an American case officer. So in other words, what the French were saying, and there's a lot of good 9/11 research from the French, what the French were saying was up until just before 9/11, Osama bin Laden was still appearing to be an American intelligence asset. And I think that's entirely plausible for several reasons, not the least being that during the Clinton administration, there were several times, as we now know, where various governments, including the Sudan, tried to offer bin Laden to us. And for whatever reason, the United States declined.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if he's supposedly at the top of your terrorist list, why do you not take up an offer to apprehend the guy and interrogate him? The second reason I think bin Laden was, up until 9/11, an asset, and probably after 9/11 was an asset, is because you had persistent rumors from, say, 2002 up to 2004, and then his final death, where he had died under different circumstances. So in other words, bin Laden is kind of the Hans Kammler of the whole 9/11 saga. He dies four or five times under different circumstances each time, and this is all being reported in the mainstream media. So to me, that signals data obfuscation. And if there's data obfuscation, there's an intelligence network involved.
Yeah.
So, yeah, bin Laden, as far as I'm concerned, is an asset. And the final, for me, Daniel, the final most convincing thing about bin Laden being an asset is the fact that bin Laden graced the American government with his official endorsement of the pancake theory. In other words, the Twin Towers came down because airplane fuel burned and melted, weakened the core columns, the load-bearing columns of the structures, and down they came. All right. Well, you'll recall in December of 2001, after 9/11, that, you know, supposedly we got a hold of a tape where he says this.
Right.
He endorses that theory, and I was hoping when we slammed those planes into it that it would cause the towers to come down, which is, you know, physically impossible.
Right. And you make the strong point that this is a guy whose family is in architecture development and building construction.
Yeah.
He's not likely to make that kind of a mistake.
Yeah. You know, the bin Laden group knows that this ain't going to happen. So here's this guy conveniently endorsing the American government's official line. So in other words, you know, and even those tapes are suspect because, as the Saudis and the Germans pointed out, the Arabic translation isn't even accurate.
Exactly.
So in other words, it appears that this video was a concoction to have him endorse the official line. You know, maybe they called him up in his cave in Afghanistan and said, hey, we need you to do a tape for us, you know?
Right, yeah.
Who knows?
And it's a heck of a convenient statement from him at that time.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah, because there's a lot of rumors starting to circulate at that point that the official story doesn't add up.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Initially, bin Laden even says, I didn't have anything to do with these attacks. So,
yeah, on top of that, you know, this wasn't me, guys.
It's strange.
So, yeah, you know, nothing adds up here. And if he's not involved, then that raises the stakes of that Saudi involvement and that odd Mohammed Atta connection and the Saudi bin Laden group connection to all these Nazis.
Yeah, yeah, right.
What are they doing here again, you know?
Well, you make an interesting point about the hijackers themselves, their intelligence connections, their misidentification by the FBI, and the possibility that based on their actions, they may have actually thought they were participating in a drill that day.
Yeah. If you look at the behavior of Mohammed Atta and the hijackers, particularly on the flights that crash into the Twin Towers, the official story has Atta and I forget who his comrade is, renting a car in Boston driving up to Portland, Maine, getting on a connecting flight from Portland back to Boston, and then boarding flight 11 and crashing into the North Tower.
Right.
All right. Now, if you look at that whole operation from the standpoint of terrorists designing an operation that is carefully coordinated to carry out an attack, would you risk the operation on the connecting flight from Portland back to Boston being on time? Would you add that extra step? Answer, no, you probably wouldn't. Okay. Because if that connecting flight doesn't make it, then, you know, you're out one target that you've carefully planned. The second problem with the whole narrative there is that Mohammed Atta and companions conveniently bring luggage with them, which luggage conveniently has a last will and testament in it. And the last will and testament begins in a most un-Islamic way.
Right, right.
By you know, beginning with, in the name of God, the merciful and compassionate, and in the name of our families. Well, no Muslim is ever, ever going to invoke their families in the same breath as they're invoking Allah. You know, this is nonsense. Mm-hmm. So in other words, to many 9/11 researchers researching just that aspect of the official story, it falls apart because, number one, you're not going to take that kind of risk and plan that kind of operation based on a connecting flight. Number two, you're not going to pack luggage if you're going to die. And number three, you're not going to leave the luggage in the car that you've just rented for everybody conveniently to find with an invocation that's not even Muslim.
Okay, yeah. You know?
So in other words, that part of the story looks suspiciously planted. Now, the problem here that 9/11 researchers have, in my opinion, is why would you plant evidence like that even if you're involved in level two? If you're involved in level two planning, you're not going to make the clumsy mistake of having an invocation invoking Allah and your family and then not even mentioning the Prophet Muhammad.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Well, it's a little bit of a problem.
It's a little problem. So I think that that aspect is a level three thing designed to draw attention to the holes in the story of the official narrative. In other words, it's salted evidence, and there's salted evidence all along that is announcing the presence of this third level. And that's one of them, in my opinion.
It's really evidence of blackmail.
Exactly. Exactly. Blackmail.
Yes, and this is what we'll explore when we come back. What was the nature of this blackmail? Why there were so many national security drills taking place on 9/11? And why were all the intelligence warnings from other countries ignored by our own national security state? This is really a heavy breakthrough, and we're just getting started here. So we'll be back with more Dr. Joseph Farrell. Stay with us.
Go deeper with Dark Journalist. Subscribe now and you'll have access to the complete audio archives to download or stream at your convenience. Receive advanced updates and discounts on Dark Journalist events. Enjoy exclusive subscriber-only content. Go deeper with Dark Journalist. Visit darkjournalist.com and subscribe now for a special spring discount available for just $39 for one full year. Dark Journalist, the truth is never easy.
They were sitting there filming, a little saucer came from, I say little saucer, it was a saucer, came flying over their heads, put down three little landing gear and landed right out on the dry lake bed. And they picked up their cameras and started over toward it, filming as they went. And when they got in fairly close to it, it lifted up, put the gear back in the wheel wells, tipped up and took off at a great rate of speed.
Dark Journalist will go there.
9/11 and the subsequent authoritarian policies developed in its wake have threatened the very notion of a free and open society.
Hidden technology.
So in other words, the possibility exists that you have here a machine that is manipulating magnetic fields on a planetary scale that has nothing to do with particle physics.
The black budget.
But there's no such thing as getting away from the corruption because it is literally... It is now integrated into every economy in the globe.
Geoengineering.
I'm talking about right down to the DNA level. Imagine that you have now put microprocessors and sensors, along with everything else, into every human body.
For more deep interviews, special reports, and documentaries, visit darkjournalist.com today. Dark Journalist, the truth is never easy.
And we are back. This is Dark Journalist, and today we've got part one with Dr. Joseph Farrell. His new book, Hidden Finance, Rogue Networks, and Secret Sorcery, The Fascist International, Penetrated Operations. It's just being released as we speak, and he was gracious enough to give us the first real interview on this. Really mind-blowing, extraordinary work. And to have this kind of depth when looking at a deep event like 9/11 really illuminates some of the heavy obfuscation on this tragedy and its global implications. Now, Joseph, we're looking at level three, using some messages to communicate to level two. What's at stake? And using this blackmail, essentially. So how should we look at this network's aims to understand the kind of goals they have in mind by using these tactics?
Think the 2008 bailouts.
All right.
There you have all the bankers in front of Congress saying, yeah, we need X amount of dollars and we need it real fast, but we can't have any oversight as to what we're going to do with it. Now, to me, that's a kidnap victim with their gun to the head.
Mm-hmm.
With a gun to their head. Somebody's got a gun to their head in those bailout hearings, and that's what they're covering up. And I think it's deeply connected to 9/11.
It has that strange feeling again, somehow.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I find truly fascinating about the 2008 crash and bailout hysteria is that sense of urgency going on behind the scenes. So there were congressional leaders telling the representatives, you have to vote for this or you will see martial law.
Yeah.
Now that's a real gun to the head.
Yeah, it was. It was. And the question is, who has that gun that they can hold to the head of the United States Federal Reserve? We all know the conspiracy theories about the Federal Reserve. It's owned by the Rothschilds, it's owned by the Rockefellers, and so on. All these private, very wealthy families that are supposedly part of the high plutocracy and elite of the West. And if you can hold a gun to those people, then who really holds the gun? And I go back to what I said many times with dear George Ann Hughes and many other people, about that deal that was made with the Nazis at the very end of World War II and then carried forward into the early founding of the Bilderberg Group. When you're dealing with Martin Bormann, you're dealing with Dick Cheney without the warmth and charm. And sooner or later, all of those markers for all of that Nazi loot is going to come due. And they have the network to carry it off if they need to.
Uh-huh.
So in other words, it's a mafia. You have the capos around their table smoking their cigars and drinking their brandy with each other while out on the streets they're shooting at each other. I think this is what you're looking at. And there has to be a group of sufficient power and global extension with their fingers all over the world, with deep connections to Islamic radical groups as the Nazis had. I think you're looking at the real possibility, and I emphasize the word possibility, that you're looking at a real possibility that 9/11 was the service of the divorce papers. Looky, looky what we can do. We're inside all of your operations. We've got your codes, and we've got some rather interesting technology that can destroy whole buildings. I think the divorce papers were served.
That is fascinating. Well, let's get into level two now, because level two is what the 9/11 investigators in the alternative research world look at. And of course, there's a lot of acrimonious debate
right
around the questions of level two and many different camps with many different ideas about it. But in any case, level two is important, and it's an important component if we're to understand the third level and ultimately the entire operation. So we have the official story, which has so many holes in it that researchers were able to go in there and dissect the reports, and many of them realized, well, this isn't the truth.
Right.
And they came up with a number of different scenarios to arrive at the real story. So again, the three layers that you've identified are level one, the hijackers, the patsies essentially, mm-hmm. those that were on the planes and showing up at airports to play this role.
Right.
Of course, right after the incident, we saw the face of Atta, for example, flashed on a million screens that day, conjuring up the Muslim extremists took the planes down image in our minds.
Who likes to visit titty bars and have drug parties? Yeah.
Yeah.
He's a real Muslim guy.
Yeah, pretty non-traditional. We have the other hijackers who are training in this flight school and are notoriously mm-hmm. terrible pilots, according to their flight instructors. And a quick thing mm-hmm. about Atta that you've mentioned mm-hmm. before is that he has German friends there at the flight school.
Yeah. Yeah, he's being constantly visited by people with names like Jürgen, Wolfgang, you know, Hans. You know?
It doesn't quite add up, does it?
We don't find very many Mohammeds or Abdullahs or people like this visiting Mohammed Atta. That's a little clue that something's up.
Definitely. Well, he's quite the European Renaissance man, apparently.
He's quite the European Renaissance. And, you know, he speaks, in addition to this, he speaks Hebrew and German, you know, which, you know, raises the suspicion bar again. You know, Atta's father claimed that Atta was actually working for the Mossad. So, you know, you've got all of these very weird things about him. But the flight school itself, interestingly enough, was involved apparently in drug smuggling and computer technology smuggling using planes that were also being smuggled, and get this, over the Arctic Circle.
Huh.
And this, again, is according to the research of Daniel Hopsicker. And when I read that, I thought, wait a minute here. You know, the Arctic Circle, you can trigger a nuclear war.
Oh, boy. You know,
if you're doing things that way. So that means with that area of the world being so closely watched by Great Britain, Russia, the United States, Canada, with that region of the world being involved in drug smuggling, either they're flying those planes dangerously low beneath the radar over the Arctic Circle, or you've got people turning a blind eye to what they're seeing on their radar scopes. You know, there's no two other ways about it.
Right.
But level two is important here because I do think the 9/11 research community got this right. You could not pull off an operation like 9/11 concurrent with so many drills on that day, mirroring various aspects of the actual 9/11 operation itself, if there were not some element within the American military industrial intelligence power structure involved in the planning of the operation and in its execution. Now, interestingly enough, that hypothesis didn't evolve first. There's an interesting sequence regarding level two. Because the first thing you'll notice the 9/11 research community focusing on is on the fact that there were so many warnings from various intelligence agencies around the world, including Russia, and from President Putin himself personally, as he indicated. Russian intelligence said they're going to target several targets in America using anywhere from 20 to 25 hijackers, which was how accurate the Russian intelligence was concerning the operation. Now, the fact that there were so many warnings led to the early hypothesis called LIHOP, let it happen on purpose. In other words, the American power structure, they argued, had these warnings. They decided to let the operation go forward, to let it happen, so that they could use that as the pretext to project American power into the Middle East and seize all the energy assets there. That's the reasoning. But then, as the research continued to unfold, they pointed out all these drills. Webster Tarpley, at one point, I think, says that there are something like 46 concurrent drills on 9/11 all mirroring aspects of the operation. So in other words, when you get that kind of precision, it's not simply a let it happen on purpose. It's now a made it happen on purpose. It's part of the plan. It's a deeply planned, well thought out covert operation. And then you add my third level, it gets turned inside out. Because again, you wouldn't need to collapse the Twin Towers to achieve your objective of having something big, huge, and dire happen to project American power. When the towers come down, that's the surprise, all right, in my thinking.
Right.
And it's how they come down that's also the surprise. We can get into that later. But
yes, they're powderized, they're pulverized.
They're powderized, they're pulverized.
One of these unusual drills that's taking place on 9/11 is called Amalgam Virgo.
Yes.
That one's important.
Amalgam Virgo is hugely important. They're all important, but Amalgam Virgo basically is an operation where hijackers are crashing planes into buildings. And there's another drill where hijackers are crashing planes into the National Reconnaissance Office, you know, our spy satellite office, on 9/11. So the National Reconnaissance Office is evacuated during 9/11 because of the drill. You have other drills around the country where military bases are being closed down to external entry. So in other words, the whole, you know, we go back to President Kennedy and his assassination and the security stripping around him that took place in Dallas.
Yes.
In the case of 9/11, they're stripping security from the entire country at the same time that they're placing all of our nuclear forces on alert.
That's so dangerous.
You know, which the Russians are watching, you know. This is the other thing that we forget. The first person that Bush calls foreign leader is who? It's Vladimir Putin. And, you know, he just informs Putin, we're going into Asia, you know, don't stop us. Well, I think that part of that don't stop us is the fact that all of our nuclear forces are on alert. You know, they're ready to press the button, which thank God they didn't.
Yeah.
But yes, Amalgam Virgo is hugely important. It's drills like that that are the indicator that level two is some rogue network within the American military and intelligence community that has planned and conducted the operation. All right. The third level shows its hand both with the codes business and in the way that they bring the towers down. And please understand very carefully what I'm saying here. There are, to my mind, four major hypotheses of the destruction of the Twin Towers. All of them are controlled demolitions hypotheses. The first one is, and the reason I'm getting technical will be apparent in a minute. The first one is controlled standard demolitions, explosives in the building that were there that brought the buildings down. The second hypothesis is the nanothermite hypothesis that Dr. Stephen Jones pointed out in a paper, that there were nanothermite particles in the rubble from the Twin Towers, and therefore the mechanism is nanothermite. Then you have the mini nukes people that point out, no, that can't work because there are hot spots at ground zero for weeks and months after the event, and that can only occur. Plus, you have radioactive components, tritium, strontium, products of nuclear processes that are there in more than natural abundance at ground zero after 9/11, and therefore we've got nuclear weapons, mini nukes of some sort, involved in taking down the towers. And then finally you have the directed energy hypothesis. Why is this important? Well, first of all, unlike most 9/11 people, I think that there is evidence for a variety of mechanisms being used. And this is where the levels become important. Because standard controlled demolitions would be the most easily accessible technology. You'll notice that as the hypotheses increase in technological sophistication, the circle of those who would have possession of them and know how to use them narrows considerably.
Mm-hmm.
So at any of these levels, you can rule out Muslim terrorists and fundamentalists. Because first of all, in any standard controlled demolitions theory, you have to go in and prep the building.
Good point.
You have to plant the explosives. And there's no evidence that I can tell anywhere in the 9/11 research literature that suggests a bunch of Arabs are going into the Twin Towers and wiring it for destruction.
Yeah.
It's just not there. The problem here then is you've got, with increasing technological sophistication, you're getting a narrower and narrower circle of people that could have pulled it off. All right. Especially.
Yes.
With the
so
last
we're going into level two here.
You're going into level two. Right. So the controlled demolitions, the nanothermite, and maybe even the mini nukes idea are level two. All right. And there's evidence for all of these. This is the problem. And with the directed energy hypothesis, the circle narrows even more tightly, because not even the nuclear commanders in the American power structure would have access to this stuff, or even perhaps know that it existed. So in other words, right there with that mechanism, you're pointing the finger at something much deeper than the ordinary hidden command structure of the military-industrial intelligence complex. You're dealing with something that's totally off the books and not accessible to them. You have to, in other words, at that level of mechanism, you have to look at groups that would be researching that kind of technology over a prolonged period of time and have the money to do it. All right. And you know, that's our breakaway civilization idea. Another code name for this global group, whatever it is, this global fascist mafia, whatever you want to call it.
So would you say then that we're going from level two now into level three?
What I'm suggesting is that the evidence itself suggests there's more than one mechanism in play destroying the Twin Towers. And therefore, if you're level two and you think, okay, it's all gone smoothly, press the button and bring those babies down. Okay. If that happens, and then all of a sudden you realize, oh my God, they're turning to powder before our very eyes. A controlled demolition isn't going to do that unless you literally pack the whole building full of explosives. All right. So you can rule out controlled demolitions as the mechanism that you see in evidence literally pulverizing the towers as they're coming down. All right. The closest thing that's going to do that is the nanothermite. But the problem there, as I point out in the book, is even though it could do that, again, you'd have to pack the towers so full of the stuff that the activity would have been noticed. It would have taken a long time to prep the building to do that with nanothermite. So what I'm thinking is that particular bit of evidence was salted into the picture to obfuscate the data and the interpretation of what happened. In other words, I think it's a deliberately planted dead end.
Yes.
When you get to the problem of the temperatures of the rubble after the event that persist, and when you get to the theory of exotic energy weaponry of some sort, once you start looking at that stuff, then you're in a very, very different realm altogether, and that's level three. And it's going to show itself, whether it's mini nukes or exotic energy, it's going to show itself in things like those temperatures, in the radioactive decay with the directed energy. It's going to show itself in a very different way. Some of the eyewitnesses, as the towers are collapsing, say some very strange things that are, to my mind, indicative of the presence of very, very high energy, energetics on that day, and we can get into that. But at that point, if you're level two and you start seeing this and hearing of this evidence, you know there's a third player on the block that you didn't intend to interrupt your operation. And that's when they know they've got a problem.
So they know they've got a major problem, and now that problem has access to the most sophisticated weaponry.
The most sophisticated weaponry, and it's penetrated virtually the entirety of the American security complex. The DEA, the DIA, the CIA, the FBI, you name it, they've got the codes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Now, how do we arrive at the major realization that Level 3 possessed these codes?
Well, the codes, the story was first brought out in the 9/11 literature by a French researcher by the name of Thierry Masson. He was the guy that focused on the Pentagon and the problem of the apparent lack of sufficient debris. And he was also the guy that pointed out that the hole that you see in the initial pictures of the Pentagon simply isn't big enough for a Boeing 777. You know, it's just not.
Definitely, no question.
There's a huge mystery regarding Flight 77. Well, Thierry Masson is the guy that first focused on that aspect of the 9/11 narrative and said it's bogus, it's bunk, we're looking at something different. Well, it was Thierry Masson that also pointed out that there were these calls to the White House switchboard where they revealed the presence and possession of these codes and then said Air Force One, Angel, in other words, is the code name for it, is next. And it's at that point that you see Bush, while he's in Florida, change from the calm, oh, nothing's really happening, let's finish the little story and go on with our photo op. Somewhere between then and getting back on Air Force One, they realized that they had a real problem. And he scoots to Barksdale and then up to Offutt after having said he was going back to Washington, D.C. So in other words, the story changes. Something happened in that time frame to indicate that they had a real problem and that he had to get personal presidential control over the command structure of the American military, particularly the nuclear forces. So there was literally a kind of a coup happening. Now, where did Level 3 get the codes? And you know, hats off again to the late Michael Rupert, because he was one of the first researchers that found this aspect of the story and zeroed in on the software promise, PROMIS, the prosecutor's information management software system.
Right.
That the Reagan administration stole from the Inslaw company back in 1983 and then modified with back doors and then proceeded to sell all over the world. And here's the interesting thing, Daniel. When you look at the countries that were giving America warnings about something happening on the week of 9/11, and you look at the countries that this promise software with its modified back door was sold to, the list is astonishingly similar.
Oh, really?
It was sold to Canada. Canada's one of the countries warning us. It was sold to Jordan. Jordan's one of the countries warning us. It was sold to Egypt. Egypt's one of the countries warning us. It was sold to Germany. Germany's one of the countries warning us. And they even saw to it that a version was stolen by the Soviet Union. So in other words, what I suspect and what I outlined in the book is when you compare those two lists, the codes are not being accessed like most 9/11 researchers think of by moles, human moles, within the American command structure. The codes are being generated by some sort of very similar promise-based software, and therefore they use those very same back doors to ride into the systems of the American federal government and get those code names.
Oh, that makes sense.
And incidentally, that's not just a hypothesis, because in 2006, that Chinese espionage case where the Chinese scientist stole nuclear secrets from America, he used the Promise software system to gain access.
That is a major piece of the puzzle. You know, Promise and the story of how it was acquired and re-engineered to do a lot of dirty work for the deep state is where we're going to go next. So, Joseph, thank you so much. Outstanding. And we'll end part one here. But remember, this episode is going out on May 20th, and part two for subscribers next week is coming up. So this really is the perfect time to subscribe. Not only does it help the program, but the shows coming up are real breakthroughs, and you're going to want to be there first to get episodes like this one. You can get the book at GizaDeathStar.com. Joseph, hang in there, and we'll start right into part two. Thanks so much.
Sure.
Thank you for joining me for this fascinating episode with Dr. Joseph P. Farrell on 9/11 and the fascist international trap. You can find more special reports, deep interviews, and documentaries at www.darkjournalist.com. You can also subscribe here to our YouTube channel to receive the latest videos. See you soon.
Dark Journalist will go there. The deepest issues, the hardest stories, the biggest secrets. The truth is never easy. With top guests, like former Assistant Housing Secretary Catherine Austin Fitz.
Catherine, who is really behind this media censorship?
Internet feeds go through satellites. Who controls the satellites? It's the Pentagon.
Legendary investigator Graham Hancock.
Graham, this cataclysm must have destroyed an advanced culture in our ancient past.
It truly was an extinction-level event. It was accompanied by massive animal extinctions. It was accompanied by huge and unexplained sea level rises, and then a sudden plunge of global temperatures.
Best-selling author Jim Mars.
Jim, don't these elite corporate owners need us around to buy their GMO food? Why would they want to depopulate?
Because they are eugenicists and they believe that they need to purify the human race. And if that sounds like the Nazis, that's exactly what it is.
Coast to Coast AM investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe.
Linda, how are we going to scale that wall of UFO secrecy?
Humans themselves are bypassing, are beginning to dismiss all of the policies of denial and lies.
Dark journalists will go there. Visit darkjournalist.com and subscribe now for a special spring discount available for just $39 for one full year. You'll not only receive access to the complete audio archives to stream or download at your convenience, you'll also get exclusive subscriber-only content and Dark Journalist event discounts. Sign up for our free newsletter to stay updated on the latest shows. Dark Journalist, let's get the real story in 2016.
You know, we need dark journalists, so just keep doing what you're doing.